It's a great song from Paul McCartney called Looking for Changes from the Off the Ground album. It's all about animal experimentation and the sometimes ridiculous lengths we go to in the name of research and the pain and suffering we inflict on animals. I know that from previous programs we've done that a lot of you listeners are concerned about GMOs, genetically modified crops, and what it means to the food you eat. Well, what about genetically modified animals? Frankenmeat, basically. You've all heard about chickens, how they've been genetically modified so their breasts are so large they can't even walk. Well, there's a lot more where that came from. There's a lab that exists. It's in Nebraska where this kind of weird research is undertaken. And the big surprise is not only that the lab exists, but that you pay for it. It's a government lab. And wait till you hear the kind of stuff that goes on there. My next guest, Michael Moss, sort of blew the lid off of this back in January when he wrote an article for the New York Times. And he joins us in just a moment. Wait till you hear this stuff. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Moss is an investigative reporter with the New York Times, and in 2010, he won the highest honor in journalism, the Pulitzer Prize, for his investigation of the dangers of contaminated meat. He's the author of a book about the processed food industry called Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. And as I mentioned earlier, he broke the lid off this story in back in January about the government meat lab and the horrors that take place there. Michael Moss, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, I read that article. When I read the article back in January, what came to mind was Joseph Mengele when you're describing some of these horrific kinds of genetic manipulations and experiments that are done there. I mean, wow.
You know, and in writing, this is one of the most difficult pieces for me to do. It took entirely an entire year to sort of pull off. And I have to say that while, you know, I don't see the scientists working there as sort of these evil, you know, scientists sort of intentionally setting out to sort of cause harm to animals. I think one of the problems that they had was sort of an emotional disconnect with the subjects of their research, sort of not seeing, you know, sheep and piglets and baby cows as being like real animals that they should sort of care about in that kind of way. The goals of their research was just to help the modern meat industry create meat that was more profitable with more offspring and easier to care for was the overriding concern and goal.
How'd you get started on this? Was it this story? Was it an outgrowth of the work you did back in 2010?
You know, it was. I had been looking. Well, you know, my very first job on a newspaper was actually in Colorado in the early 1980s, covering agriculture. And more recently, for the Wall Street Journal and for the New York Times, I was looking at some of the Department of Agriculture policies relating to food safety, as you mentioned, especially in ground hamburger. And one of the researchers at the center remembered my work and sent me a note. This is now a year and a half ago, saying, "Hey, you know, I'm at this place and there are some things going on, and I would love to tell you about it." His name is James Keene. He's a veterinarian researcher. And over the years, and he worked there almost 2 decades, he became increasingly concerned about the welfare of the animals at this USDA research center. And he reached out and he said, "Hey, I think I would really like to tell you about some things and have you take a look."
So let's walk us through it. It's called what's the name of this place? It's the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center.
The Meat Animal Research Center, referring to cows, pigs, and sheep, that's their primary focus. It was founded just about 50 years ago in order to consolidate the federal research programs aimed at helping agriculture, farm animals in particular, funded by an entirely, you know, wholly owned unit of the Department of Agriculture, so funded by taxpayers. You know, staffed by some 200 scientists and their helpers associated with the University of Nebraska, out kind of in the middle of south central Nebraska. It's about a 2-hour drive from Omaha, 55 square miles of prairie land, and And entirely focused, as I mentioned, on sort of using surgery and breeding techniques to increase the productivity and lower the cost and increase the profits of these three animals.
So let's give us some examples. Pigs, for example, what are they trying to do with pigs?
Well, pigs, one of the problems with pigs that the industry was sort of seeing is that pigs were not having enough piglets. And so it was this center that came across sort of the key to increasing the size of the litters for piglets. And they did so through this surgery where they would remove one of their ovaries and do sort of testing and trying to figure out sort of where's the bottleneck in the pig's physiology that was preventing it from having piglets. They succeeded, you know, beyond their wildest expectations. The industry then ran with that and, using kind of traditional breeding techniques, began making pigs that had more and more babies. And so over the years, we've gone from, you know, a pig litter of typically having six or seven or eight piglets to now 14, 15, sometimes more. And there's a problem. And the problem is called crushing. Because when you have that many piglets, the sow, despite her best intentions and motherly instincts, you know, will stand up, lie down, roll over, and crush inadvertently a piglet. And as best as I could tell through my estimates, because the industry doesn't sort of like to talk about this, you know, every year we have at least, you know, 1 million or more of these piglet crushes. It's sort of the hidden cost of making pigs more profitable, because obviously if you have more pigs, you're gonna have more poundage sent to the slaughterhouse. I mean, that's the goal. But the crushing, the deaths of the piglets, is, as I mentioned, this unintentional and but, you know, entirely expected, you know, expectable result of this research.
Wow. So, I mean, it doesn't get to the point where it's not productive enough, it's not profitable enough to have more babies. They get crushed. You still have a couple more baby piglets, so you do make more money even though a bunch of them get crushed. Nah, it's just a cost of doing business.
You know, and that was the exact same point that they made with cows. So, we're talking 20, 25 years ago, they got this, no, even more actually, they got this notion of developing a cow that routinely gives twins instead of single cows. And twin cows are not unknown out in nature. 1 or 2% of cows born will be twins. And usually it creates great angst on the part of the rancher because twin cows are more apt to get tangled in birth. When a female is born with a male, her genitals will typically be messed up, and she'll be unable to have she'll be able to get pregnant herself. And once they are born, so the twin cow is typically going to get less attention from the mother, who's used to having just one cow. Well, because twin cows would provide more poundage at the slaughterhouse and thus more profits, this center set about creating a herd of cows that was twinning at rates of 50-55% compared to 1-2% in nature. And again, wildly successful, but the death rate of the baby cows was running as high as nearly five times as high as single cows because they would get tangled up in birth, they couldn't be extracted because of sort of being rejected by the moms, and then you had this female genital sort of mutilation problem as well, which is less kind of economic, but just sort of a trauma for the ranchers. I mean, it's sort of awful to sort of deal with.
It's just kind of creepy, you know, isn't it creepy that for millennia cows give birth to one calf at a time, and then we suddenly it's two and three? It's just.
Well, it's not nature. I mean, you know, they are pushing evolution, if you will, but sort of basically sort of pushing these animals to do things and to, you know, to quickly evolve by their own surgery and breeding techniques, you know, far beyond what nature sort of wanted. So very disturbing to not just, you know, some of the researchers who work there, although many will defend their work vigorously, but to many people in the industry. And that's when I really knew something was amiss here, is that when I went to real world ranchers and talked to them about this, they were appalled at some of the research that was being done here and making really strong arguments for why profit was in fact, you know, yes, part and parcel to the system of agriculture, but not their entire concern. And just the other day, we had one of the biggest food suppliers out there of all, Walmart, declare that it was now going to start paying much more attention to animal welfare procedures and systems on the part of its suppliers than it did in the past.
You note in your original article from January that, you know, we have the Animal Welfare Act that's supposed to sort of help prevent a lot of distress and death and suffering for animals, but there is a big exemption.
Big loophole for farm animals. So back in 1966, when the Act was passed, people were mostly concerned about the use of dogs and cats, animals we would keep for pets, in research labs doing experiments to get things like better cosmetics and drugs and what have you. And the Act was passed to protect those animals because they pull on our heartstrings. I mean, who would want their pet sort of, you know, put through, you know, a research lab that wasn't, you know, with experiments and wasn't paying attention to the welfare of that animal? Well, you know, farm animals were expressly exempt from the controls of the Act. So ironically, the USDA, Department of Agriculture itself, enforces the Animal Welfare Act, but those inspectors who are experienced in protecting the rights of those animals are not allowed to go onto farms or big operations or their own research center in Nebraska to look at the treatment and the way farm animals are used in experiments.
So I'm sure you dug up all the paper trails and figured it out. USDA had never been there to take a look in their own backyard.
Well, one of the benefits, if you will, of this center being the government is that they are beholden to the Freedom of Information Act. And so I was able to obtain through that act memos and emails and death records and all of the experimental plans and all of the thinking and planning or lack of thinking and planning that went into these, I think they totaled 800 experiments over the years, which opened a window kind of not just on this one research center, but frankly, some of the research that goes into farm animals at private institutions as well.
James Keen, you mentioned him, veterinarian scientist who tipped you off to this and got you on the trail. Are there any consequences for him in helping you to uncover this thing?
You know, he's a really interesting person. I mean, deeply caring about animals and there are kind of two types of research scientists there. There are those who have like one little specialty and they kind of focus on that. And there are those who also have veterinarian degrees. They are doctors for animals, and they are charged with protecting and doing everything they can to sort of save the lives of animals. And so it was especially the veterinarian scientists at the center, including Dr. King, who became sort of, you know, increasingly concerned about what was going on there. He's had a really tough time because he was bold enough to reach out to me and speak out to me and talk to me on the record. And he's had a pretty rough time. A number of his colleagues have criticized him. Some have been incredibly supportive behind the scenes. I mean, he's still working for the University of Nebraska Research Center, which has an adjoining operation there to teach students, somewhat ironically, about how to care for animals. Okay. But it's been a very difficult goal for them. It's been a very difficult time for him because he wasn't comfortable sort of coming out and speaking publicly. In part because he'd been working there a good 2 decades and had some, had some rough feelings about why he didn't speak out sooner.
I know in your original article it said that you had talked to about 2 dozen current and former center employees. I would imagine there's a range of reactions to them when you start asking them these questions, and a range of how cooperative they were.
It was very difficult reporting. The center declined to let me interview the director, the top people, or anybody. It declined to let me visit the center. I asked several times, give me your tour. Let me hear your views and justification. So I had to work very hard at getting people who work there now and formerly to talk to me, because I really wanted to see their viewpoint, because it was just what Dr. Keene was describing, what the records were describing, was just so foreign to me as somebody who used to write about agriculture and somebody who eats meat and had sort of a basic care for animals. And eventually did. Eventually I did speak to close to 2 dozen people, and there were mixed views. And as Dr. Keene sort of points out, I mean, a lot of these people don't think they're doing anything wrong. They think they are driving science to benefit society and feed a world that's going to have 9 billion people by the year 2050. And in their view, the only way you're going to feed those people is to create systems that will make, lambs and piglets and baby cows, more productive and cheaper to produce and more profitable for the industry.
Well, there is another way. You could eat less of those and eat more of plant-based food, I
Well,
guess.
there's that. And one of the overriding sort of things I got from those interviews is that while they will talk about animal welfare, it's mostly in the framework of keeping an animal healthy enough to be productive. They're not sort of talking about animal welfare in the way that Walmart is, or some of these other big grocers, Whole Foods, which is, or some of the hard, crusty ranchers. I met this president of the Nebraska Sheep Association who once sort of explained to me, and we spent a bunch of time on his small family ranch, and he once explained to me with his eyes tearing up how when one of his lambs would get in trouble during birthing, he would take the ewe to a vet and pay for a cesarean to save that lamb, knowing that he would lose money on that operation. I said, "Why?" And he said, These are God's animals, and if anything, we have even a bigger obligation to give them as good a life as possible before they have one awful day at the end, by the way, when we slaughter and then eat them, because we're raising them for our benefit. A moral obligation, an ethical obligation. And this is a rancher, and I was really, really struck by how many sort of the disconnect between this research center and real world ranching. And I have an idea sort of what's driving that disconnect.
Yeah, I know a lot of ranchers who have the same sort of attitude about their animals. They know where how it's going to end, but in the meantime, they take care of them. It's not the same with these factory farm operations and these
And on a
gigantic.
pure calculation, maybe it isn't profitable, but one of the things also I really struck me is that more and more people, consumers, are caring about the way animals are treated for meat that they eat. And I think that is what was missing from the research at the center. And that was one of the huge lost opportunities there, is that they could have been spending time looking at ways to promote animal welfare and to kind of work on that part of the equation and find ways to save those piglets and develop animals that had better lives. And you could then run with that as a commercial trait. Hey, I'm raising piglets that have a fantastic survivability rate. And you can label that and promote that and advertise it. And I'm convinced that more and more people are willing to pay more for meat from animals that are treated really well.
I think you're absolutely right. I can only imagine what the reaction was like when your article was first published, and we'll get into that, and then the government's response as well. In the next segment, Bob Dylan doesn't want to work on Maggie's farm anymore. He takes us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, so I'll apologize for playing this song. It's "What Does the Fox Say" by these Norwegian comedians, Ylvis. Figured we could use a moment of levity after all the serious stuff we've been discussing tonight. That video, by the way, released in 2013, has been viewed 519 million times on YouTube. So apparently somebody likes it. I apologize if I have stuck that song in your head. We're talking with Michael Moss about his expose about the government meat lab. I posted an article on the Coast website. This is one he wrote back in March, kind of a response from the government to his initial articles that came out in the New York Times in January. And within that story that we posted, you can find the link to the original reporting as well if you want to check that out. When we come back, we'll talk to Michael about government reaction to his story, also a little bit about his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us, and we might take a call or two from our listeners. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Moss, I've covered a lot of animal welfare stories over the years and have heard some horrible things, but I remember when I read your article back in January, I think my jaw dropped. I mean, when how I had never heard of this meat lab in the first place, and then the stuff that they were doing there. What was the general reaction? It must have gone off like a bomb.
Yeah, I mean, some of it were from vegans, people who don't eat meat, and this was just, more evidence that the notion of sort of eating meat is unacceptable to a certain number of people. I was really struck at the reaction from ordinary ranchers who, some of whom were appalled, and were very quickly, wanting to distance themselves from the goals and practices of this center. The Humane Society sort of jumped on it and helped rally members of Congress who decided that, and a few dozen of them have signed on to legislation that would end the loophole and subject this center and other animal research to the Animal Welfare Act. And one of the things that's happening here too is that I think the USDA is gradually realizing that it missed the boat on animal welfare, and that when it's designing these experiments, it wasn't, but it should be factoring in the safety, the welfare of these animals, just as a just from crass commercial interests, if nothing else. I mean, if you're gonna help American agriculture, that you have to help them in a way that's gonna meet consumer demand, and consumer demand is going in that direction. So, they're trying to be there for farmers in a way that I don't think they were in the past. And then finally, to sort of install some oversight. One of the this center wasn't even following the Department of Agriculture's own rules about having kind of the equivalent of an institutional review board to protect the animals. And so they were coming up with these experiments and not having the kind of committee in place that approves the experiments and then reviews it and monitors it over the years with an eye toward animal welfare, and keeping records of that. So I think that's one of the things they're looking at now changing as well.
Well, we posted the article that you wrote in March, and it seemed to me, as a journalist, that you must have had been like biting your teeth. The agriculture department's response to this—they send some guys, "Oh yeah, we've looked into it, and there's a couple of things we can improve, but it's okay."
It's the Department of Agriculture, and I'm sort of used to that. I mean, it takes them. It's like turning an aircraft carrier, but in some long extended bureaucratic version of that. It takes them forever to turn. And, they're under enormous pressure from certain segments of the meat industry. And I think much of what was driving the policy decisions and research decisions at the center were the slaughterhouses, who are simply wanting bigger animals because it's more profitable to kill them and having sort of zero concern about the welfare interests. And that I think is what's behind sort of the agriculture's sort of slowness. That and also maybe just being defensive about themselves. Look, I mean, this had to be deeply embarrassing to a number of people there.
Well, it's also magnified because you're a Pulitzer Prize winner. I mean, I know you're not a guy who wants to brag about that, but that makes a difference. When you're a Pulitzer Prize winner and you sign your name, your bylines on this story, it gets attention, doesn't it? It changes your life.
Well, and that came from also just, reporting on the Department of Agriculture's, in this case, sort of its lack of oversight of the meat industry when it came to E. coli and other pathogens in meat, especially hamburger. There were some clear things that the meat industry could have been doing in order to reduce the risk to consumers that they weren't, and at a minimum, the USDA was asleep at that switch long past when they knew the right thing to be doing on behalf of consumers.
Let's talk for a minute about your book, Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. I can guess what the theme is there from the title.
Well, yes. And in fact, speaking of pathogens, I was continuing to write about problems with meat when one of my best sources in the meat industry said to me, "Hey, Michael, and he tests meat for E. coli for the industry." He said, "Look, as tragic as these incidents of contamination are, you really kind of should look at what my industry intentionally adds to its products, and has absolute control over." And he was mostly concerned about the vast amounts of salt used in processed meats. But when I started looking, there was sugar and there were fats. And I was incredibly lucky to come across a trove of documents that put me, at the table of the largest food giants in the world as they're formulating and marketing and selling their products. And it was those records that allowed me to identify key people in those companies and get them to open up and tell me even more secrets about how they do it. And the overwhelming sense you get from that is that they are driving day and night, not just to get us to like their products, but to want more and more of them. And in some cases, and one of the really striking things about me is that there are cabals of insiders at these companies who became increasingly concerned about their responsibility, not just for obesity, but for diabetes, for gout. There are people who work for these companies that even link their products to several types of cancers and have been fighting from within to try to get these companies to change and come up with truly healthier versions of their products. And it's been a hard go
Man,
because
you know
these are
what comes to
companies
mind?
doing what all companies want to do, which is to make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible. And their way of doing that, at least until now, has been using large amounts of salt, sugar, fat to make their products low cost, convenient, and utterly irresistible. And as your listeners know, obesity is out of control. One in three adults, one in five kids for a certain age, more than 20 people with type 2 diabetes, the type associated with bad diets, over, I think, 70 million with pre-diabetes. Last time I counted, there were 8 million Americans with gout. Remember that one? I mean, gosh, the totally tied to sort of diet. And again, sort of like animal welfare, more and more people are starting to be concerned about what they're putting in their bodies. They're starting to be concerned, and coast to coast, not just LA and the East Coast, but in Nebraska and Kansas. And it's amazing how many people I've heard from in that regard. And they're starting to put pressure on these food giants to really truly change their ways and rethink their own addiction to using too much salt, sugar, fat to make their products profitable.
It makes it what comes to mind is the image of the eight tobacco or seven or eight tobacco giants appearing before Congress saying, "Oh, no, we have no evidence that this stuff is addictive."
Oh,
those
well, in fact,
internal.
you mentioned that, and I spent a whole chapter looking at Philip Morris because kind of forgot about this, but back in the late 80s, the biggest tobacco company of all, Philip Morris, became the largest processed food manufacturer in North America by buying the old company General Foods and then Kraft. And it was actually through the tobacco records that I was able to sort of see how they sometimes would even lend some of their marketing schemes to their food people to increase sales. But actually, and surprisingly, it was none other than the Philip Morris executives back in the late 90s who turned privately to their food managers and said, "Hey guys, you're going to have as much trouble over salt, sugar, fat, obesity as we are now with tobacco and cancer, and you've got to do something to lessen your dependence on using those three ingredients in your products." This was back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And that's really when the clock starts ticking on the processed food industry, and when obesity is still ramping up.
A lot of attention has been given to the idea that these processed foods, the ones that are bad for us, are relatively cheap compared to the stuff that's good for us, vegetables and things like that. People in inner cities who can easily get access to a Big Mac and fries and not so much fresh tomatoes and produce.
Oh man, it's so hard to walk into a grocery store, meaning to do the right thing by your health, by your family's health, when you go to the produce section, and a little basket of blueberries will cost you as much as a, 2 pound, 4 cheese, 3 meat frozen pizza that will feed your entire family. There is a huge imbalance in the agriculture system where we are planting some 90 million acres of field corn for high fructose corn syrup, et cetera, ethanol, versus 5 million acres for all fruits and vegetables. And that creates this disincentive for financial disincentive and hardship for people to eat better and healthier. And now, of course, we have the drought in California where some 80% of our vegetables are being grown. And I think there's a real concerted effort out there, A, to help farmers switch over to growing more vegetables, which everyone says we should be doubling our consumption of for better health, and B, then helping to market vegetables and sort of put those back on the plate, because the smartest nutritionists I talk to, the first thing they will say is not even worrying about the salt, sugar, fat, is fill up half your plate with vegetables and some fruits, and you're 90% of the way home to a better, healthier diet, and the rest of the stuff it'll be easier to take care of itself.
Michael, we'll try to get a call or two in. Callers, I hope you remember Michael is the investigative reporter for the New York Times, so he's not here to represent the views of the Humane Society, but keep that in mind as you make your questions and comments. On the wild card line, Josie in Wisconsin. Hi, Josie. You're on with Michael Moss on Coast to Coast AM.
Yes, good morning, George. Thank you so much for having this subject. I'm a member of the Humane Society and all that, and a lot of other organizations. But I feel that I'm 70 years old, and I've been looking at this problem for years and years. And I feel that the basic problem is human overpopulation, because if you don't have so many people needing meat, which I feel I'm a vegetarian myself, I just feel it's that's the whole crux of the problem. And it's just unbelievable if we have 7+ billion people on this planet. It's just unsustainable. I just see that. I know I'll probably be dead before the things really start to get really, really bad. But I feel that's the whole thing. And how are you going to convince people to have no more than 2 children in the whole world, in other countries? It's just so enormous, the cruelty, just the whole thing, the drilling, extracting everything from this planet. It's just overwhelming. There's no words really to express the horror of it all. And I feel ashamed many times to be a human, to tell you the truth.
Jesse, let's let Michael get in here. Michael, I guess you know that is where a lot of the excesses come from, is the
Yeah, and
need
I
to
think
keep
that's one
up
of the
with
burning
growth.
questions here too is, I mean, who should be making decisions about, I mean, let's just say we can't stop the population growth from reaching $9 billion. I mean, who's going to be making the decision about the smartest way to try to feed those people and have other concerns about the environment and the animals and our own sort of eating health? And I have to say, you look around now and it's basically the big producers, the industry, the slaughterhouses that seem to be in charge, and dominating sort of these and the food giants and making packaged foods, who are dominating the conversation about what's the best way to feed that population. And there's a tiny little voice out there like this caller saying, "Hey, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't be trying to make a cow or a lamb or a piglet that's going to feed 9 billion people. Maybe we can get protein to people in a smarter way than animals. Why don't we just eat less meat, but it's quality meat and the animals cared for, and try to get our protein from other sources?"
I think it's an important message that, you know, I've got some messages over the evening, of course, of the program from people who confuse this as being a message that don't eat meat. That's not, I don't think, what you're saying. It's not what the Humane Society is saying, is if you're going to eat it, there are better ways to raise it. It doesn't have to be cruel.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, I mean, I still eat meat, although I have to say it's getting harder and harder for me to sort of walk into a restaurant and not ask the waiter or the waitress kind of like, "Where's the meat coming from?" Kind of in the hopes that, you know, they're buying from a small producer, but there's even large producers as well who are paying more attention to animal welfare. Yeah, I don't think it's about that at all. I mean, there's lots of reasons why you might not want to eat meat. For people who do, and that's what really strikes me, people who do and want to continue eating meat are caring more and more and deeply about the welfare of those animals. And that's, I think, the message that's slowly getting through to the producers and the Department of Agriculture.
You're encouraged by that Walmart thing. You mentioned it a couple of times, and we discussed it earlier in the program, the idea that the market could have at least a solution to some of this stuff. I mean,
Yeah,
Walmart making that
absolutely. And
decision is
in
huge.
fact, in writing, you know, the book Salt, Sugar, Fat Too, and looking at sort of processed food, I became kind of hugely focused on ways that we could encourage the industry on its own to make meaningful changes. Look, this is an industry that's driven by profits. It's under pressure from stockholders, from Wall Street, and that's how they make decisions. And if we can figure out ways to show them that they can make money selling nutritionally healthier foods, selling meat from animals that are cared for humanely, then that's just such a more powerful, more reasonable way to sort of effect change than rather to sort of try to work, you know, through Congress, which is going to have all kinds of pressures on it to not respond. And, you know, Congress is usually risk averse, and so are these large companies. But by showing them kind of the finance, this is a capitalist society, and by showing them kind of the financial smarts in doing good food processing and good meat raising, I just think that's a terrific way to kind of frame the solutions.
Any follow-ups to that story? Are you staying on it? Is it going to become a book?
You know, I'm writing another book now that actually is going more deeply into food and this question of food and addiction, especially looking at high fat, high sugar foods. So I'm kind of off in a different direction. But yeah, I'm keeping tabs on Department of Agriculture. I'm very much sort of looking forward to their final announcement of reforms, kind of both in the way they're thinking about their research and the way they implement research projects. And if any of your readers want to get in touch with me, I'm sorry, if any of your listeners want to get in touch with me, I'm certainly eager to hear from people. Always looking for stories that need to be told and uncovered.
Michael Moss, thank you very much for being here. I know it's pretty early there in New York City, but thanks. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having this show. It means a lot to a lot of people, I'm sure.
All right, the salt, sugar, fat, how the food giants hooked us is the name of Michael Moss's book, if you want to check that out. I want to thank my earlier guests, Wayne Pacelli, Kitty Block, Adam Periscandola, Josh Balk, and my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, George Norrie, of course, Tom Danheiser, Jeff Duray, Dan Galani, Chris Boros, our webmaster, Sean. I'll be back tomorrow night. Good night, everyone.